I'll try and see you in the dramatic lighting here. And we have two people on each side who are going to, in fact, bring the microphones to you, Rebecca and Sunny. So I'll wait until they get to you when we ask questions. And if you could say who you are, that way we can effectively sue you. Thank you. They think I'm kidding. Yeah. Eric, you know, I love the kind of the way you divided the thing up into three. So I want to sort of start by big questions from each of the three sections. And it occurred to me, in listening to the kind of heaven, hell, and innocence thing, that there are other models and other places for that kind of combination of things. And I think of politically Hegel, the thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. Mm-hmm. I think of Blake, innocence, experience, and going through experience brings you to a heightened kind of innocence. Both of those are models of, in a sense, reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you have a sense that painting, and using it specifically, is also, for you, a kind of model of reconciliation if we look at those three frames. I mean, where do you situate yourself inside the framework that you've set up as a kind of trinity of possible allegiances?
Figured I'd start small until we get to the quantum questions.
That's so good. God.
Eric's an old friend. a former friend.
Well, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, first of all, I cast out this fairly large net, and then I personally feel like I'm working in a rather small area of it myself. But, the painting I did of the travel of romance.
Yeah.
Somebody, in looking at the last panel of it, started talking about redemption. Like that was the journey, that there was this redemptive thing because of the light and stuff like that. Yeah. And in saying that, I thought, I would never
have thought.
I wouldn't have thought it. I also wouldn't have tried to claim that as something. You didn't use the word redemption, but what word did you use?
It was reconciliation.
Reconciliation, yeah. So it's the same thing. You know,
sort of more political.
Yeah, I don't have any way of knowing or really controlling how the work functions outside mm-hmm. of my own making and what I take from it. So even if I felt that I was reconciling these. Mm-hmm. Huge contradictions in the work, in almost like that biblical thing, I would never acknowledge that or think that somebody else would get that out of it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I end up, you know, trying to make paintings that where the narrative is open-ended. I think that the part of my technique is to try to find a moment that is just before or just after something is going to happen, and that's where the experientially dramatic moments are, and so it's about stopping before I get into that. So basically, what I'm throwing out to the audience is an object that is open-ended, for them to decide how they want to participate mm-hmm. in it and maybe even confront that sort of reconciliation of
so when you say
things, I'm painting, I'm painting people that are awkward in their bodies. Mm-hmm. They're not comfortable with the things that they want and need.
So in a sense, the ideal painting for you, if you were going to escape your paintings, would be, I mean, the ideal body is one that you've said elsewhere. You can't imagine anybody being fully comfortable with their body. So that sense of awkwardness is something that you obviously think is necessary for the painting and is inevitable in your painting because of the way you approach the body.
Yeah. I mean, my people and my imagination are very real. You know, they're not metaphoric. They're not abstracted and stuff like that. They're it's sort of reductive in that way. I mean, actually, I've done these, the last few paintings I've done, which you saw a few of them, and there's a few more. I look at them and they're like utterly banal. Not in that the painting is without art, but that what I'm looking at is such a real world of adult relationships, you know, such a reduced kind of moment. That I think people who know each other and have some history, you know, you just feel like I've seen this 1,000 times, seen this 1,000,000 times. This, you know, we're in the bathroom together. This is going on. You're doing this. I'm doing this. This is life, you know.
Why do they seem so fraught with weight, though? If they're merely domestic and banal, what's the charge? Is the charge not in the content, but in the handling, in the way the painting is made, and the way it looks as a thing made out of pigment on a surface?
I don't know. I think part of it is that I think we look to, we want to see something better than ourselves. You know, we want to see something more, and maybe the weight is in that. You know, this kind of frustration and the inability to transcend the moment. I don't know. I mean, I don't actually see maybe I'm so actually in the tragedy of life, you know, that now I'm almost reconciling it, myself to it anyway, because it just seems like, well, that's life. You
know. But what,
in
what
early work, I railed against it.
Yeah. One of the things that's always really intrigued me about the way you make a painting is the way you tell yourself stories in the making of it. So that in the early Glassine work, you could literally manually shift things around to get your imagination realized in space. But right. And now Photoshop allows you to do the same thing in a sense. But it's always a process, isn't it, of you telling yourself a story
right. That
you fit these characters and objects into. Do you think of yourself as a kind of dramatic storyteller in that way?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's the process is really a one in which I intuit something, some meaning, and the meaning's in the character. There's some gesture, something that intrigues me. I want to contextualize it. I want to see if I can change it. I mean, I mentioned several examples. One is like, how could I look at this and think this person doesn't own this bed? You know, what's telling me that? Mm-hmm. You know, and so then I throw things at it. I tried once. I didn't show the painting, but I tried years ago. I did this painting of a father hugging a small child.
Daddy's girl,
and it was right at the point in my career when there'd been enough writing about it. About what I did, you know, with these phrase psychosexual suburban drama, blah blah blah, you know. And people, you know, the underbelly of, you know, daily life, et cetera. I thought, I wonder if I could do a happy painting that no one would notice. Because they're already thinking I'm thinking bad thoughts, you know. So I found that, you know, this moment, you know, a father hugging his young child. I'm thinking, what could be sweeter, right? Now, in the photograph I had of this, it was a person on the beach, a friend of mine on the beach, hugging his child, spontaneous thing. He was wearing a bathing suit. In my painting, I took the bathing suit off.
That certainly didn't complicate things, did it?
Well, call me naive.
Now, should we call him naive?
No, seriously, call me naive. Now, this is kind of interesting if we think of heaven, hell, and the garden.
Yeah, it is.
In one sense, what I was trying to do was project it into the pre-lapsarian moment, mm-hmm. You know, the harmony. Here they are integrated into their, you know, it just happened to be a sort of fancy bourgeois house and stuff like that, but you know, they're outside on the chaise lounge, and you know, it's this beautiful day, and they're hugging, and, you know, what could be sweeter? But I kept thinking, they're not going to get it, You know, this seems like a dangerous moment. It's not the innocence I was looking for. What am I going to do? So I put the mother in on the other chaise lounge. And then I thought, that's a cop-out. There has to be a way of conveying innocence without, you know. So I took her out, and the feeling returned. So I put the gardener in. I figure a guy, he's not looking, but, you know, he's watering the plants, you know, something like that. I mean, nothing's going to happen. But it didn't work. I struggled terribly. At one point, I actually put myself in the painting.
Really didn't work.
And I knew I was in deep trouble.
Exactly.
You know? And it was all by way of trying to diffuse the situation, you know, that came so loaded. When there wasn't a lot there other than our deep, deep fear of the body. You know.
And incest. I mean, clearly what's being circulating in our reaction to that painting is this fear that this father, the daddy's girl, by the way, that phrase, as you know, is a classic phrase that fathers use for their favorite daughter, quote unquote.
What are you saying?
I'm saying you're probably going to be put in jail before you go back to America for that painting. But you know,
the thing is that what I realized that in my own process of trying to deal with it was that it was precisely that nobody else was there that was causing that we couldn't trust he would observe boundaries. Right? That was the thing of it. That, you know. Anyway,
you do a brilliant thing in that painting, though. It seems to me that what you do, because if you know that painting, there's a planter there, and on the corner of it is a glass of iced tea that is just sitting precipitously on the edge of falling off. And that glass seems to be a kind of symbol for the situation going either way. I mean,
it also is sort of precisely halfway between you and them. So it's somehow pulls you into that that thing. It could be your goal. You could reach to push it off the, you know, pull it back from the edge kind of thing. So
there was a wonderful poem by Canadian poet Robert Croach that has the line, "The bed is ark to all the world's destruction." Mm. And it interests me that the bed has played such an important part in your work. There's the destructive side of the bed as a place of sexual encounter, of psychic trauma and all that is clearly an underlying principle in much of what emerges in the painting, I gather. Mm-hmm. Is there a positive side to it as well, or is it a reading that fundamentally is a kind of destructive arc, that the trajectory is one where people are being maybe damaged?
I think that in some of the later bed chair paintings, there's a kind of you know, welcome and delicious erotic thing to it. Mm-hmm. Seems healthy, not negative, but generally probably it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, it also is like, you know, it is a canvas as well. It is this, you know, sort of, you know, not unlike a canvas of, you know, cotton and rectangle and stuff like that. So it's kind of me putting a painting within a painting, so to speak, that arena of it, but sort of making some connection between the way we live and the way we imagine.
And that arena coming through our history, I mean, I was going to ask you, beauty is important to you in that Bonar sense, the desire to create beauty, obviously, that you want to make good-looking paintings. I mean, I was shocked in the new show in New York how beautiful those paintings are. I mean, you really are painting up a storm now. Has that become a real preoccupation, the quality of the painting as well as the content of it?
Yeah, well, I think it's also that I've always been interested in, you know, one of the dramatic elements, one of the characters of the work has been the light. Yeah. And, you know, trying to find the light in which this behavior takes place, which sometimes reifies it, sometimes is in contrast to it, et cetera, et cetera. And in painting, in the pursuit of painting light, you move into, you know, a deeper and deeper sort of relationship with how to paint something, because light's incredibly complicated to evoke as, mm-hmm. as a material.
And in fact, your light is getting so bright, it's almost obliterating. I mean, a lot of the paintings from the Crayfield Project are have a light in them that is like Emily Dickinson's White Exploit. It's like you can't even look at it almost.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's in a way that you know, if there's any kind of mystical or metaphysical side to it, then the light is starting to play that thing, and that would be the heavenly side, mm-hmm. whatever else that. Where the light obliterates in a kind of you know, decorporealizing, mm-hmm. if that's a word, you know, mm-hmm. you know, dematerializing the human in a way.
A final thing before I turn it over to other people as well. I love your dramatic presentation of the range of art that runs through the idea of this is art, and then the violence done to the body, real violence done is art, but then the documentation of it isn't. Just the frame of what's happened from Van Gogh through to what we see in the more recent work you showed is, in fact, a pretty dramatic trajectory over that 100 years. Do you have a sense of why? I mean, how much further can it go, or have we reached a kind of end game with that, and now we recover some of the territory?
Well we were talking at dinner a bit further about this. I had made a comment that that I thought that technologies were sort of in the vanguard of our culture right now, and that art, and certainly painting and other sort of more traditional forms of art, were in the rear guard of the culture. And we were talking about you know, sort of video games and stuff like that. And I had this image, I could see it, where you know, in the context of the removal of the body from art, that it's broader than that culturally, and that in fact what we have now is we have a situation in which children are exercising like this, you know, where the body's getting reduced to, you know, the eyes, the brain, and the hands. And the hands are the thumbs, you know, working these games. Instead of, you know, before that there'd be more encouragement to go out and play sports and stuff, which involves the whole body and to be more physical in the world. And then it starts to separate. So, you know, I just see a trend anyway that's mm-hmm. that's there. And then of course, there is really anorexia. There really is bulimia, and there really is cutting and stuff like that that are epidemic in our culture. I don't know, in Canada, I assume it's happening here. It certainly is in the States. And so it seems like there's a crisis that's coming. I mean, it's counterbalanced by the fact that we have this whole fitness stuff going on, and we do have, you know, people, you know, the sort of Charles Atlas kind of buff body is coming back, is idealized in one hand. So there's something's going on. I don't understand it exactly.
Maybe all moments are transitional, and it's just that it's only given us enough of a perspective from them that we then allow them to cohere into something that seemed to be a stopping off point. And then from that point on, I mean, I wonder what Van Gogh would have said. You know, these are conjectures, but or what any artist says about what a sort of period is. I guess what we want to do now is turn up the lights. Can we do that? So that it's not perfect. And I just want to invite anyone in the audience to ask a question. I just insist that either one of our two handlers get you. So and you'll only have to put up your hands so that they can recognize you.
So I'm on? Oh, yep.
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Martin Holmberg. And I just wondered, I hadn't seen that picture, the daddy's girl. But from the description, if you were trying to get to innocence, why would you take the bathing suit off?
Well, let's say if we talk about it through the analogy of the Garden of Eden, when they were naked before knowledge of the body and sexuality and stuff like that. So in a way, it was trying to couple it by taking it back into a kind of innocent place. with the question of being, why should we be ashamed of our body, even though, in fact, we are. So.
Well, since you didn't have a medieval context or a mythical, classical context, then that would be a bit explosive, huh?
But why? Nothing's...
You said that the viewer was everything, right? And if you know your audience, or at least you know the general climate of the audience, then you would know that they might do a bit of eye-popping about this.
Right, but let me say something about audience. I said the audience is everything. I believe the audience is everything. But I've also said, and I stand by it, that you give the audience what they want, but not what they think they want. And by that I mean that what artists should do is undermine preconceptions that people come to the experience with so that you can open them up to some other way of looking at it. So that's part of how I was trying to construct that. You start with the fact that you know they're going to be nervous about it. You know they're going to think that it's a bad moment. How can I set up it so that everything they think is going to happen, they can't prove, it's not going to be there. What's going to make you think this? Why are you going to do this, blah, 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 Except that it comes down to this one thing, which is they were naked and they were alone. It comes down to two things.
One of the ironies was the drawing, they were alone there, but because he had his bathing suit on, the drawing for it, in a sense, is much less problematic from that what's going to happen point
really
of view.
It really is innocent.
Yeah, it is innocent. I mean, there they are on the beach, and it's safe, and they bring it back to the high modernist home with all the accoutrements of culture, and suddenly, it looks dangerous.
Right. I mean, the other thing, thinking about what you're saying, why, it lacked the context of the garden, that sort of pastoral place, blah, 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 that we associate with good and innocence and so on. That's one of the things that I've always been pained about and tried to work with, tried to deal with, et cetera, and also as part of the tragedy of being now, which is that we don't have those mythological spaces. They're cliches. We don't actually have the narratives. And, culturally, we're not as unified. We're not unified around a religion, or we're not unified around a, political structure, or this or that, et cetera, et cetera. We don't have the narrative. So, and I'm sure every artist here knows it, you have to create your world. You create the stories. You create the characters, you create the situations. What I try to do is to look for something where there's an archetypal thing present that might be possible, that one would look at a beautiful home, an unspoiled home, and would think of innocence, Of course, anyone with a political mind might find it as though bourgeois, but you got to deal with that. But anyway, my point is that trying to find something. I one of the reasons I for the longest time worked with the sort of the family matrix of husband, wife, mother, father, sister, brother, mother, son, father, daughter, blah blah, that thing, was that it is an archetypal structure, so that you can spin it backwards culturally. You can start to hook into all of the mythologies and stuff like that, and still sort of couch it within a contemporary setting. But it always, in doing that, made me feel at the same time like I was, doing it all by myself. That was part of the alienation, was part of the reality of time today.
Another question? There's a couple up there. Oh, look at that. That's right. What do I have bid on this artist from America?
Sorry.
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
Hello.
Hi. I'm Aggie Bainan. There are two things. One is I watch the change in your light in the paintings. It seems to be almost exotic in the later paintings. And a comment you made about using Photoshop now, and that you don't even, you don't, I'm not sure I'm quoting you right, but you don't think about the story, you just get into the painting. It's, you didn't say meditative, but I kind of intuited that from what you were saying. I was curious, number one, is there kind of a relationship between the light and what's happening now? And the other thing is, I'm not quite sure I understand how you're painting now that you're using Photoshop. I just wanted you to comment on that a bit.
Okay, the, you know, I construct my narratives from collages of photos that I've taken. So I take this figure from this photograph, this chair from here, this figure from here, this bed from here, whatever, and I sort of put them together in Photoshop, and then I manipulate them in Photoshop. So I, you know, this figure I want to be more in the foreground, this one I want to be in the here, and the bed I want to be here, or no, I want it to be here, I turn it around, you know, whatever. I work with it till I, in telling myself the story, I come up with the image that tells that story for me. Now I have it, I print it out, and then I go and I start painting it. Now I have the thing that I'm painting. It's like a very developed sketch.
So you can still mess with it. Once you've got that, you can still play along.
Yeah, and also you still have the problem of interpretation. I mean, anyone who paints from life, from direct observation, knows that, you know, you go through, you still have to interpret what you're seeing, that there's not an easy relationship between I see that, I mix the paint, I draw it, I paint it, and it actually looks like that. You have to coax them into to being. So that's where the painting takes place. This, what I was saying was that I already have the narrative. I've already told myself the story, so now I go to paint it. Now, why, some people might say, would you bother making that translation from a photograph, which has its own interest and integrity, to a painting? Like, what's the difference? And that's where you get into some very interesting and, I think, very complicated stuff about the nature of, precise nature of painting versus photography versus film. Okay, I'm going to preface this all by saying that a thing that April has pointed out, which I think is true, and it has to do with the, you know, first with like you know, slides and transparencies, reproductions in magazines, and now with the internet and with you know, JPEGs, etc., is that we've become a culture, and not just a broad culture, but actually an art culture of visual illiteracy. And we're finding more and more that people who actually know about these forms aren't making the distinctions. They're looking at a charcoal drawing and they're saying it's a photograph. You know, they're looking at an oil study and they're calling it a watercolor. These things may seem small in one sense, but in fact they're not, especially for painters who make it, that all of those things carry huge significance to them in terms of creating precise experiences. And so what is the difference between a photograph and a painting, say? Well, one of it is that a photograph captures something. They use the language to that. It captures something. It actually captures a moment in reality, and it captures an incredibly small slice of reality, but it really captures it. A painting creates that. It builds to it. One, it's a construction. It's not a capturing. It's not a pulling out of life. It's actually a building up from life to something that mirrors life. So that there's inherently a different relationship that the viewer has to the object. And there is a kind of distancing because of the objective nature of photography. The non-participatory, the sort of the all-seeing eye, the thing that that a photograph makes you feel alone with it, whereas a painting makes you feel connected. And you're connected to the artist as you watch how they built this moment for you. It's a big difference. And so my relationship, why I paint, is because I want that connection. I want to be connected to you through this object. I don't want to push you away. I don't want to alienate you. I don't want to like create something and disappear in that way.
Thank you. Carol Thompson, you've done some very beautiful watercolor gestural drawings, which seem to be quite distinct from what you're talking about today. It seemed like a much more positive outlook, maybe, on the world than some of the things you've been talking about. Do you want to comment on that?
No, of course. It plagued me for years. It was like one of these things where I tried to bring into my paintings a kind of spontaneity that the drawing, the oil studies had and stuff like that. Because the oil studies were small and I wasn't involved in like trying to do the faces and get them to be real characters and stuff like that. You know, the whole experience of them was so much more erotic because I wasn't trying to, you know, like define a beach as anything more than a swash of color, or you know, the water as anything more than a swash. You know, it had this incredible freedom to it, and it was like the Eros side of my being, my imagination. And I thought, you know, what is the matter with me? I'm so crippled. I'm so demented when I go to make these paintings. And is it just that the painting is I'm making it too precious, and so I'm overworking it and over detailing it or whatnot? And then finally I realized it's a different part of my imaginative structure, and that it was okay. You know, it was all right to just have it be what it was. And you know, and then of course I suffered terribly because, I'm glad you asked, I suffered terribly because I started thinking of Anais Nin and how extraordinary her diaries were, which she considered her lesser art, right? But how, what a greater impact they had. And then when you read her novels, they're turgid. You know, they're overthought out, they're over, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, I'm her, aren't I? This is it. I'm a major minor artist. You know?
If she'd spent more time screwing Henry Miller instead of writing those diaries every night, she'd go home every night and write a 50-page diary. I mean, she was crazy. Yeah. That was the madness of Anais Nin. It's all that writing. She should have lived more.
Beautiful, though. I was schooled as an abstract painter. At the end of the 60s, early 70s, you know, art school, not only was painting dead, but if you had to paint, at least paint abstract art, you know. So it, because figurative art was really dead, you know, that was the difference. So I was schooled as an abstract painter. I love abstract art. I did it for a while. Actually made a transition from abstraction to figurative when I was living in Halifax. And one of the reasons I did was I wasn't good at it. Every abstract painting I did, was the last painting I could ever do. There was like so not a natural flow that it was incredibly painful, and you know, and the stuff was imitative anyway. So,
Didn't you have a painting in that Canadian Canvas show that time circulated in 1970 as an abstract painter from the Maritimes?
Yes, I did. In fact, the Edmonton Art Gallery
owns it. See, the only Canadian, the only painting of fair official owned by the Edmonton Art Gallery.
Which I disavow any artistic, any aesthetic value in that painting whatsoever. In fact, I'm going to write him a letter now. Yeah.
For years, Eric was considered a Canadian painter.
Yes.
In Europe, they used to list him as a Canadian because he lived here for 4 years.
Well, actually, my great experience, a real heart warmer, was the art gallery in Ottawa, the National Gallery, owned some more early work of mine from Nova Scotia. And next to the thing, it would say, you know, Eric Fischel, in parentheses, American, 1948 - end of parentheses, new parentheses, Canada 1974 - like that. And I thought, God, born again. I mean, you know, this is fantastic.
There's another couple of questions. Questions, and then we'll.
Hi, Shannon Reynolds. My question is about your titles, and especially as a narrative painter, about whether your visual world is bound up with language. And I guess I want to know whether you conceive of your titles before or after you paint your paintings, and how important your titles are. Do they still remain incredibly important to your paintings? And there was one other part that I've forgotten, but I'll let you answer.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. Next question. With like Bad Boy and Sleepwalker and Daddy's Girl and those early paintings, the title oftentimes came to me in the painting and clarified it for me. And it would kind of show up and it would lead me at the way out of the picture, crystallize something for me. Then I started to have a lot of trouble with titles. And in fact, the majority of work that I've done that is titled, I don't remember. So it doesn't have anything to do with the paintings. Mm-hmm. I remember the paintings well, but I don't. And I think part of it was that, in fact, when I was making the transition from abstraction to figurative work and narrative painting and stuff, I went through a period of drawings, you remember, yeah, these, where, and I, part of it was because I didn't trust my ability to draw. I was very primitive, and I would do these primitive sort of feeling figures and stuff. And then I would sort of put a word or a phrase or something to go with it that would spin it in the direction I wanted to go in, because I wasn't sure that I could actually convey that. I was more, you know, adept at the word than I was at the image. And then when I was painting, in those early paintings, you know, I was struggling so with how to paint and what it was and whatnot, that when the title would help me, you know, get through it. But when I became more familiar with where I was, what it was, the territory I painted in, the words just dropped away and, you know, whatever. And so, you know, people say, oh, I love that painting, Reflection 2, and I'm like, I actually named something? Yeah. So I don't know.
Yeah. You hear this?
Yes, Paul.
I've always been amazed at how the images in your paintings are so memorable, whether you want to remember them or not, they kind of etch this vision in your retina. And I wondered if that's something that you've thought about in relation to the theme tonight that you've talked about, and number one. And number two, if it's something that you think about or could talk about in relation to your early work and your most recent work. But this quality of visual memory.
Right. Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because that leads me to one of my other theories, which is that there are two kinds of artists. And there's the one artist is the kind who creates work that when you stand in its presence, you are you feel its authentic power, its energy, it's, you're brought into the experience of it and whatnot. When you leave, it all kind of blends together. If you think of a painter like Pollock, you can describe a general thing with Pollock. You know, drips is, you can't describe the specific work really. It's too much energy, too much of that. Or, you know, in Bosch, for example, Bosch, you know, his Garden of Earthly, that you can pull out certain memorable images, but you also have a whole lot of stuff you don't remember, and they're just like this kind of energy source of strangeness going on, blah, 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 right? And you can find that throughout. So there's this, that one kind of artist where the residual effect of the experience of their work is the memory of the energy of it, and the emotions that go with that. Then the other is the artist where you see it once, you never forget it. It's like every detail is burned on your brain, or on your retina, as you're saying. And you think of Michelangelo's, you know, God trying to touch, you know, Adam kind of thing. And so you see that for you, that's it. You'll always remember that. Edward Hopper's a great artist in that regard as well. Alex Colville's another one that does that, etc. And so, yeah, I think my work falls into that category of retinal memory. In terms of the second part of the question, between my early work and now, are you talking about, has there been some change between the two or what? I don't think so, but yeah. Yeah. No, I think I make every painting where I try to find that moment where I freeze it, that is a crystallizing and sort of a searing moment, so that it's like that's how you would describe that. When you describe the experience of it, you will describe it exactly like you saw it.
Yeah. And you've said that you know a painting is finished when you become its audience.
Right. Yeah, there's a point at which you know, you stop being the artist because you've sort of solved all the problems of the painting. The hand is the way you want the hand to be, the light's the way you want the light to be, the color of this, the composition, blah, blah, blah. So you're not looking at it like the artist looks at it, picking it apart. You're actually looking at it the same way people coming to it are looking at it, which is to say, what the hell's going on here?
One more question, and then we'll retreat upstairs. You're all welcome to come. So which, there's a gentleman here. Did I miss somebody? I'm sorry.
My name is Ron Solway. You described your more recent paintings as being banal, and Robert had asked, well, if they're in fact banal and so domestic, what energizes them, or what is the charge in them? And you had said that you like your paintings, the narratives, to be open-ended, and I suspect that that's what makes. What is the energy in them? I know that I recall reading Alex Colville's Dealer in Germany saying one time that one of the reasons that Colville was as well received in Germany as he is that and the Germans have a word for it, but there seems to be in Colville's work this impending sort of possibility, or not possibility, but an impending occurrence. You said you like your paintings to be a slice of time, a moment before the fact or a moment after the fact. And so I'm wondering if this is an observation that you can live with, that it allows the viewer to bring their imagination into play, that something is imminent. And they can take that where they will with sort of the the information that, or the point of the embarkation that you've given them, and also if that is an observation that you can accept. I've noticed also the dramatic lighting in more recent work, and it seems to me that this perhaps is even another device for allowing where often the attitude of the subject, of the figure of the subject in the painting, isn't really apparent. There are obscured areas, that type of thing, and that it also allows for more of the, well, forgive the term, the baggage of the viewer to come into play.
Was that a question?
Well, it was kind. It was, I suppose, in a way.
I'm going to turn it into one anyway.
Yeah.
Especially to the second point, which is about the dramatic lighting and stuff. One of the things that, let's see, how to say it. It was certainly something that I experienced. I went to Rome. A lot of the work that you see where there's the real chiaroscuro kind of dark light stuff going on was from after a time I'd spent in Rome, looking at a lot of Baroque paintings, Caravaggio in particular, and stuff. But and also sort of living in the churches in Rome, which are all that kind of light of, you know, sort of dramatic sunlight and stuff, and then this incredible shadows and darkness and things. And, you know, it was such a contrast to contemporary reality that it made me miss something. I felt like, gee, part of my imagination isn't allowed to go there if I just stay with contemporary light. That part of the way that the historically the paintings worked was that there was a shadow world. There was some other aspect, you know, that sort of Thanatos kind of realm to this, the darkness, to the shadows. There was this feeling of things lurking, or that, you know, demons being, or that, you know, whatever that had this kind of power to it. And you know, gee, isn't it a shame if you light everything with a fluorescent light, or you know, photograph everything with a flashbulb and blah blah blah, and you kind of obliterate all of that. You're obliterating a part of the imaginative mind, and so, you know, that I think a lot of the work that I've done since then has just been on trying to allow some of that space, that umbra space, whatever it's called, to kind of come back into the narrative thing, and you know, some of it I find humorous too. I mean, that there was one painting I showed, which obviously works better when you see the actual painting, where, you know, you see this partially clad woman on one side, and, you know, in a bra and slip and stuff, and then her body disappears, and then there's the chair, and then on the other side you see this kind of head of this man, and he's looking down, and his body disappears, but there is feet illuminated. I just thought that was really funny. You know, I just thought, of, you know, a guy, it's like one of those experiences where maybe it was from being stoned as a kid, but, you know, kind of look down, those can't be my feet. No way.
I'm surprised, the only thing you, I'm surprised to hear you mention Colville in the context of your work. One of the things that's always struck me about Colville is how undramatic and unlit. I mean, I know his things are about a kind of narrative apprehension, and you're nervous, but it's not because they're necessarily good paintings. I mean, that's where the question of content
done
versus...
some good paintings.
But the point I'm making is would never place him in the context of the other painters you mentioned or yourself
really?
At that time. That's interesting, Colville, because he's a dry painter.
Huh?
He's a dry painter. Yeah, you're a wet painter.
Yeah, no, he's dry. He's very northern in that way. And then, you know, certainly the light he uses, the northern light, which is a kind of cool evenness to it and stuff like that. And then there's the puritanical aspect of it, so that, you know, everything is kind of precise and, you know, has a kind of edgy distance.
And the guns, you know, and stuff.
Yeah, and whatnot, which is very melodramatic, but, you know, that painting he did of a German shepherd sniffing the semi-truck's tires at the gas station. I mean, that's a work of genius. What? Well, you know, it's like you look at it and you feel like something ominous, you know, and yet there's nothing. It's just a dog sniffing a tire.
If any of you want to ask Eric about sniffing any object, we're going to retire upstairs, and he will entertain your questions. Thank you very much for your questions tonight and your attention.
Thank you. Thank you.